Thanks, Barry. Hi, everyone, and thanks for coming to hear me talk about this work. This is joint work that I did with my supervisor back in Oxford, Bob Cooker, and another PhD student in Oxford, Karmia Skandola.
Hi again, everyone. So, as the title says, I'm going to talk about reconstructing quantum theory, and it's going to be from a process theoretic point of view, which is to say, essentially using lots of diagrams and trying to hide all of the sort of categorical boring underpinnings of mathematics underneath some pretty pictures. So that's the goal. I'm going to try and keep the talk quite pedagogical, so if things aren't making sense, please interrupt, and I will try and elaborate on things. So to start with, what is a reconstruction of quantum theory? On the very basic level, it's kind of a very dry subject. It's really just some set of mathematical postulates, PI, and then some sort of proof that says that this set of postulates is equivalent to the standard set of postulates of quantum theory, so the Born rule and Hilbert spaces and all of that stuff. So this foundationally isn't very interesting until you start saying, okay, well, that's one way to go. Why should you want to construct a quantum theory? That's kind of the more interesting question. And then that guides you in terms of how you go about this and what sort of postulates you consider and what proof techniques you use. So the reason to reconstruct quantum theory is really just a dissatisfaction with the standard postulates of quantum theory. And I think the best way to explain this is by contrast with special relativity. So in special relativity, you have postulates such as the speed of light being invariant. And this has weird consequences. It says that you don't have any notion of simultaneity. And this is a counterintuitive feature of special relativity. It's something that in our sort of everyday life we don't experience, and we have to abandon our notions of our everyday life to understand physics. So we have these counterintuitive axioms, but on some level they're still relatable. They talk about the speed of light. Speed is something we understand, light is something we see. We kind of are comfortable with what this postulate means, even if it's weird. In contrast, the axioms of quantum theory are so abstract, I would say, that they're not even counterintuitive. I mean, saying that a state corresponds to some sort of equivalence class of vectors in a Hilbert space, I mean, that means nothing to me, really. It's just a mathematical definition. So you can't even say that the axioms of quantum theory are counterintuitive. They're just abstract. They don't mean anything. So we know that quantum theory is weird, but it would be nice if the axioms, at least, were something we could understand, so then we could maybe understand why it's weird. And if we can do this, this would provide a new foundation for quantum theory. It would give you a new set of mathematical tools to use to understand the theory. And this could hopefully allow you to go beyond quantum theory, either to unify it with general relativity or just replace it entirely with some deeper theory of nature. I think there's good reasons for wanting to have this more intuitive picture for the theory, even if by making the axioms relatable, this then highlights the weird features. So I should say that this idea of reconstructing quantum theory is not at all a new idea. In fact, you can trace it back to 1935 with von Neumann, who formalized quantum theory in the first place. But there was a lot of mathematical problems in actually coming up with a fully fledged reconstruction of quantum theory. And really, it was only in 2001, I would say, where reconstructions really started gaining more prominence and coming into their own as a part of quantum foundations. And this was started by Lucien Hardy, who's here at the perimeter, in this paper, Quantum Theory from 5 years of Axioms. And since then, there's been a whole bunch of other reconstructions from various different perspectives. And all of them really try to have some set of postulates that are in some sense better than the standard postulates of quantum theory. And by better, I mean that they should be conceptually appealing, or they should mean something beyond just the abstract mathematical statement. But typically, people also want them to have some sort of theme to them. They want to be consistent in some way. So a lot of reconstructions have taken the postulates all to be operational in nature, or based on information, or the older reconstructions were all trying to base reconstruction on modified logic. But there is some virtue to the standard postulates of quantum theory, and I think that some of these are what ends up getting lost a bit in many reconstructions. The sort of mathematical precision of the postulates is often fudged a little bit, and often the postulates that people use are really not as simple to use in practice for doing calculations as the standard postulates of quantum theory. So often people just reconstruct quantum theory and say, right, now we know it's equivalent, let's go back to our old way of doing quantum theory. Whereas I think it'd be nice if you found postulates that actually, in day-to-day practice of being a physicist, replace the standard postulates. So then, I guess, to make this talk interesting, I should say why this reconstruction is different to any of the others that you may well have heard about already. And really, this goes to the start of the title, and that's that we work with process theories. And I think this provides a new mathematical and conceptual framework for studying physics, and in particular studying quantum theory. So I will now spend most of this talk really introducing what process theories are before actually getting to introducing the postulates and showing you how the reconstruction all actually works. So to start with, I'll give a bit of history of the development of process theories. Really, it started about 15 years ago when Samson Abramsky and Bob Cooker in a computer science department in Oxford discovered that you could replace the standard linear algebraic way of doing quantum theory by category theory. And category theory is kind of a very abstract and esoteric branch of mathematics, which it was quite surprising that they started finding any practical applications at all. But really, I would say that it isn't the category theory itself that has proved useful, but it's the fact that a particular branch of category theory, or a particular type of category called symmetric monoidal categories, have a particular diagrammatic representation, which symmetric monoidal categories. So you have diagrams. That's all you need to know. That's all I know. This particular branch of category theory has this diagrammatic representation. And then it's really this diagrammatic representation of these theories that we've lifted away from the category theoretic underpinnings to define what a process theory is. So I'll try and give like a cute example of this transition between these different ways of presenting quantum theory. So yesterday, when preparing this talk, I tried to do a calculation using the standard notation that I've forgotten about entirely. And this is just entanglement swapping. So Alice and Charlie, and then Charlie and Bob each share an entangled state, and you want to get it to the situation where Alice and Bob share an entangled state at the end. And this was my attempt. And it's kind of a mess, partly because my handwriting is terrible, but partly because I've got some terms and some expansion I did up here, and then I got bored, and there's some question marks. I think there's some terms that should be here, which probably mean that this is equal to this. And it probably works out. I think linear algebra is okay. But it was a mess, and it was tedious. So then the good thing is you can replace this lovely calculation with a category theoretic calculation, which looks like this, which I'm sure everyone will agree is beautiful and much better than that one, right?
What do you take this from?
This is from a paper called The Categorical Semantics of Quantum Protocols. This was like the first categorical quantum mechanics paper. And they had this kind of stuff going on. But as I said, you have this nice diagrammatic representation, so you can forget all of that and the horrible linear algebra stuff as well, and get this simple picture. And this is a proof that entanglement swapping works. And it's almost a tautological calculation, really. And this should make sense by the time I've introduced them a bit more formally. The idea here is really this represents, it's just a picture of what's happening in the protocol. This thing here is some correlated state between Charlie and Bob, another one between Alice. And then to attach this together to make this sort of shaped wire, because all that matters is how things are connected together, you just draw a line connecting them up, and then that's it. So this should make more sense later, but I hope you agree that at least it's a little bit simpler to look at than this, and captures operationally a bit of what's going on in the protocol as well. So this new language, this diagrammatic language, is conceptually appealing because you can see what's happening, you can sort of understand the structure of the protocols, and it provides convenient notation, which in particular is very good at throwing at a computer and getting a computer to do automated reasoning about it. So it's not just that it's intuitive for me to reason about, but also computers seem to like this way of doing quantum theory as well. And also, there's not really anything particularly quantum in what I've described here. This has very wide applicability, from linguistics through to cognition or like game theory. So the same sort of proofs you can use again and again and again in different fields, and it saves you a lot of work if you want to do things in areas other than quantum theory. And then this process theoretic way of looking at things really gives you a conceptual shift in how you view physics. So I think the standard view of physics is really that physics is all about having some state, and then you evolve it in time. So you have some initial conditions, and then you propagate them with some differential equation. That's a typical way of doing physics. Whereas the process theoretic way of doing things says, no, that's kind of not what physics is really about. It forces you to say that physics is really fundamentally about processes and about how processes compose together. And this viewpoint gives you a new framework, which lets you reconstruct quantum theory, which is one of the reasons why I like it. So now I'll get on to the mathematical slide of the talk and define what process theories are.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Do you use the standard set of postulates and you just introduce like a new set of like notations to calculations, or do you use a different set of postulates?
So the original categorical quantum mechanics research program was just taking the standard postulates and re-expressing quantum theory in this new language. What I've then tried to do is say, okay, let's ignore the standard postulates entirely and start from a set of postulates, which I'll introduce in a bit, which are process theoretic in nature, so they fit within this framework nicely, and then show that that gives you the standard postulates back, and that we get all of the sort of categorical tools coming back out of that. It should make sense by the end of the talk. If it doesn't, ask me again. Okay, so process theory is defined by, as the name suggests, a collection of processes. And a process is something that looks like this. So this is a process called F, which has a couple of inputs called A and B, and then it has three outputs, two which are called B and one called A. And then a process theory is just some set of these processes with different inputs and different outputs. And these could represent like really anything, essentially, or anything that I could care to think about. They could represent just the physical process themselves, or some mathematical representation of the physical process, or they could be some operational characterization of some piece of lab equipment, or blah, blah, blah. Like, most things you could think about will fit somehow into this paradigm, I would say. But there's one really important rule about process theories, and that is that you have to be able to wire these processes together to form diagrams, such as this one here. By wire them together, I mean you take an output of one process and feed it into the input of another. And the key thing about process theory is that this diagram has to be a process in the theory as well, which means basically that you have to be able to draw a box around this collection of processes and say, this thing is another process. It's kind of trivial in a way when you start to try and consider what these processes mean. If they're physical things, then something happens here, some system comes out and goes into another one, and something else happens, well, that's just another process that could have happened in the world. And it's not completely free, this way of wiring stuff together. There's some rules that are really kind of implicit in the sort of diagrams I've been drawing, but are worth just highlighting for precision anyway. One thing is that you can only take a single output to a single input. You can't have two outputs feeding into one input. You also need the types match. You don't want to have some sort of this is an output A, it can't go into an input D. It wouldn't really make sense.
So the first diagram, you're just saying you can't merge wires.
Yeah, basically.
They could both go into the triangle.
Yeah, they could both go into the triangle, but they have to go in as different systems. There has to be two inputs to the triangle. And really, that's subsumed by this, but this is not a minimal set. It's just useful to highlight them all. The other thing is that this should be acyclic. You don't want to be taking, well, you can't be plugging an output into an input into an out. You get the idea. And moreover, you don't want this to happen even if you have a load of processes. You can't sort of loop back on yourself. And similarly, you can't have outputs going into outputs and inputs going into inputs. So, aside from this, though, this composition is completely free, and anything that you can write as these sort of diagrams is a process.
Sorry, what are these last two? These look fine to me.
No, they shouldn't until you anticipate the bit of talks that I'll get to in a bit. Just to people familiar with the categorical quantum mechanics stuff, you do draw diagrams like that, but in the basic framework, those aren't there.
Being fed into an output, and what's the
No. So this is two outputs. Well, one output being fed into an output.
And this is an input.
An input being fed into an input.
Okay.
We'll get back to those in a bit, but for the moment, they're not allowed. And then this diagrammatic notation is also, there's a bit of redundancy in it. Really, it's only how things are connected together in these diagrams that matters, rather than precisely how things are laid out on the piece of paper or the screen. So, for example, these two diagrams are literally the same diagram in this framework. Even though you've sort of pulled this down and pushed this up here, everything is still connected together in the same way. And also, you sort of imagine that things are connected at the border of your diagram as well, so that the ordering of the outputs, the free outputs and the free inputs, also matters. You can't just swap over these things, which becomes important when you try to start sticking things together. So those two are the same. These two are definitely different in the framework. OK, and then that's it as far as the framework goes. That fully defines what a process theory is. So as I said before, this is very abstract, very general. But there's a bunch of special processes that are particularly important when it comes to describing physics. So I will highlight them. And in particular, they're given nice diagrammatic notation to make them clear. So this thing, which looks just like one of the wires I was drawing, that's the identity process, so doing nothing to the system and just leaving it alone. This is just swapping two things over. Again, it just comes for free with the diagrammatic way of presenting things, but you can also think of it as a process that does that. Processes with no inputs and output are called states for obvious reasons. And then processes with an input but without an output are known as effects, and they really correspond to the outcome of doing some measurements, or at least when you start trying to put physics back into the framework, they correspond to the outcome of some measurements. And then if you compose a state with an effect, then you get something with no inputs or outputs, and you just call that by a little box, or sometimes you're lazy and drop the box and just write a letter to represent what this is, and this is called a scalar or a number. Typically in physics, these things are going to be probabilities, so this is like the probability of getting some effect given some state. That's kind of the intuitive picture, at least. Okay, so to try and make this a bit more concrete, I'll run through a few examples of what people will probably be familiar with from quantum foundations, at least. So the first is how to present quantum theory in this language. The processes of quantum theory are just completely positive maps between Brown's operators on Hilbert spaces. This would have some Hilbert space as an input, some Hilbert space as an output, and some CP map between them. And then you wire these together following the standard rules of doing quantum theory. Then you can also describe possibilistic classical theory in this framework, where you just have stochastic maps between sets. And then you can stick these two together, which is very convenient for doing work in process theories generally, and this will be what we aim for in our reconstruction. And this is process theory where, rather than just having precisely quantum systems, you have general C-star algebras. So this subsumes stochastic maps and sets in the classical case, and also gives you the quantum case. And this lets you represent things like measurements and choices of state preparation in a very elegant way by just having classical systems coming out as your encoding your probability distributions over your outcomes, your measurements. But as I said, this isn't just probabilistic work. You can also have possibilistic theories and many other theories, but possibilistic ones are quite nice. For example, you can go from probabilistic classical theory to possibilistic classical theory, and you just go from stochastic maps to relations. And Speck and Stoy model can also be represented in this framework, and it's just some sub-theory of this possibilistic classical theory. So, as well as sort of being of interest to people in quantum foundations, all of these example process theories have something in common. And that's that they have a whole load of symmetries and dualities that all have a really nice diagrammatic representation. So I should stress at this point that these symmetries and dualities are not completely general to all process theories, they're just a particular nice feature of these ones I've presented so far. And I'll explain what they are now. So the first of these symmetries is the adjoint, typically called the dagger in categorical quantum mechanics. And this really gives you a way of time reversing your theory. So you have a process with an input A and an output B, and then you can flip that upside down and have a process from B to A. And we introduce this asymmetry of the processes just to make it clear that this one is a flipped upside down version of that one. You could also write F dagger here if you wanted, but it would be a redundant notation. But not only does this reflect individual processes, but it reflects diagrams as a whole. So if you apply the dagger to a diagram, it flips this upside down whilst preserving all of the connectivity.
I'm not sure I understand the top figure. So F is the same in both cases or not?
So in standard notation, this would be like F and F dagger. But the fact that this is the dagger is encoded diagrammatically by the fact that the box is turned upside down.
OK, so this is something you're going to use. If you flip the box,
it means the dagger, yeah.
OK, great.
So it's just convenient notation. As I said, you could put the dagger there as well. It would just be redundant, so we don't bother. So that's the first symmetry. And as I said, this is really interpreted as the time reversal of a process. So if you have some unitary process going forwards in time, then the dagger of that gives you the inverse unitary, so it undoes the time evolution. And this is going to be important in the reconstruction later. OK, the second symmetry or duality that I'm going to talk about is the generalized Choi-Jankowski isomorphism. And this diagrammatically is represented by bending wires, which lets you start connecting inputs to inputs. So say we have a map, we want to turn it into a bipartite state. That's one direction of this duality. Well, the simple way to do it is you take this input and you just bend it into an output like that. And for the other direction of the isomorphism, if you have a bipartite state to start with and you want to turn it into a map, you just bend one of the outputs into an input.
So in that case, don't you have the same input going into two cases, in some sense?
Yeah, so here you could say that this is something that is like an input here to the F and an input to the identity process here. And this is sort of connecting them together.
Yeah.
So the way around that is that you've got to interpret this thing here as a state in your theory. So this is just a particular nice diagrammatic way of representing a particular state in your theory. And it's a state because it's got no inputs and two outputs. So it's a bipartite state. So to check that a theory has this sort of isomorphism, you have to find the right states and effects in your theory. And then once you have those, then you can give it this nice diagrammatic representation and do all of your work with that. But to make sure this isn't actually an isomorphism between states and maps, you've got to check that going one way lets you go back in. That was terrible, you know what I mean. So all you need to do that is this simple or sort of obvious diagrammatic rule. As I said, only how things are connected together matters. So the fact that this wire is wiggling about is irrelevant, so it's diagrammatically equivalent to the identity transformation. And then you can see that if you take your map, turn it into a state by bending the wire up, and then bend it back again, well, by this rule, that's just the same thing as you started with. So you have an isomorphism between these things. And as I was just saying, this really ends up getting interpreted as a particular state in your theory. And so what does this mean for process theory to have this sort of state and effect? This is really capturing something about there being perfect correlations in the theory, such that whatever happens on this side of your state here also happens here. It gets transmitted along the wire.
Mm-hmm. So this seems like something that would hold in every process theory then, if it's just a bending rule.
So it doesn't.
Isn't this argument just as good?
Well, it's the maximally entangled state. It's the maximally entangled measurement. If you have a GVT which doesn't have a maximally entangled state,
yeah,
or doesn't have a maximally entangled.
What about this argument? It breaks down.
So what breaks in this argument is that you can't draw wires back on themselves in general process theories. So you can't just draw a wire that goes back in time.
I mean, the fact that you can bend it back means you can only do that if there exists this maximally entangled effect. If not, you cannot take a wire and...
So as I said a while ago, you have these limits on your compositionality. You can't connect inputs to inputs, outputs to outputs, or have cycles. if you allow for these things completely freely, then that allows you to have all of that stuff. So these are forbidden by the fundamental rules of the process theory, apart from in special cases, which is when you have this particular state and particular effect which represents perfect correlations, at which point you can introduce this, and then you can violate those initial rules. You can connect inputs to inputs, outputs to outputs, and create cycles. So this is a special case. This is a special structure for certain process theories, but it's not at all generic. I mean, if you have something that you can represent in this way, then this argument is generic, because only the connectivity of things matters. But in most process theories, you just can't draw that in the first place.
Question.
Yeah.
In the beginning, we said that you can't go from input to output and vice versa. And isn't this what we're doing here essentially?
So in a process theory, by default you can't, but in this special class you can. So essentially, if process theory allows for a Choi-Jung-Hausky isomorphism, then you can violate that rule that I said at the start, and you can connect inputs to inputs.
Okay.
But it's done.
The only rule that can be violated from all the rules that you get?
You could probably find ways of violating the other ones as well, but they again would correspond to special features of process theory. So, for example, you might have some way of merging wires together, in which case then you connect two outputs into one input, but that would be another special structure. So, this is a special structure that you have to add in addition to the basic framework. Okay, so one of the nice things about this isomorphism is that it gives you a completely general way of defining the transpose in a theory. So the transpose of the process F is just to take the input and bend it into an output, and the output and bend it into an input. And then we represent that by the process being rotated by 180 degrees. Intuitively, you can think of sort of grabbing hold of A and B and pulling them, and then that spins F round, so it looks like that. That's the basic idea. And then it's quite easy to check that this is idempotent. You do the same thing twice, and then notice that this is connected to this, so you can just rewrite it in this way. So it's sort of trivially an idempotent operator. Sorry, I don't mean idempotent at all. I mean, do it twice, it goes back to itself, the original, is the identity, whatever that's called. I'll let me do it twice itself.
Okay.
Transpose twice is the identity. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay, so then finally you can construct a conjugate operator from this, which is you take the dagger, so this is the upside down box here, and then you transpose it. And this gives you a fourth orientation that you can draw your boxes in. So if you put all of that together, then you have a Z2 cross Z2 symmetry for your process theory. You have your initial process here. You can flip it upside down using the dagger. You can flip it horizontally using the conjugate, and you can go diagonally by doing the transpose. So you have this nice symmetry between the processes in this theory. Okay, so you've got all of the symmetry. This is, again, not generic for all process theories. It's just a special case, but it's true of all of the examples I listed before. So I guess this is all like nice diagrams, but why should you care about all this? Well, it's quite useful for actually doing calculations. So to give the first example of the teleportation protocol. So suppose Alice and Bob share some perfectly correlated state, this cup-shaped piece of wire here. And Alice has some state psi, and she wants to get it to Bob. Well, I think given what I've told you already, it's kind of obvious what Alice needs to do here. She needs to just connect those two together. And then by the diagrammatic rules we've introduced, this equality is true, and Alice has done something that gives Bob a state. So that's teleportation. In quantum theory, the same diagram is true in classical probability theory or in spectrum flow model, or in possibilistic classical theory, or C-star algebras generally.
In this example, like the classical information set is important in the protocol, and it's not evident.
Yeah, I've ignored that because it makes it more complicated. Really what this cost wants to do is a particular outcome of measurement. So then you would have to look at all of the other outcomes, and then in those cases you'd have some unitary correction that happens here, which then gets pushed over to here, and then you'd have to communicate which outcome happens. The usual story. You can represent all of that diagrammatically, and it's quite nice, but it takes more tools than I have time to diffuse at the moment. So I'm sticking to the sort of post-selected or I just happened to be lucky and got the right outcome case. So what I like about this is not only does this make it really easy to do the calculation, but it really guides you as to what needs to happen in the first place. If you know you have these resources, there's the obvious way of getting to this. So it's not just that it makes it really simple to do the calculation. The calculation is completely trivial, but it tells you what you need to do in practice to realize this protocol as well. Let's go back to this entanglement sharing scheme that I talked about at the start. Again, it's a similar story. You have Alice and Charlie and Bob sharing these correlated states, and you want to get to the situation where Alice and Bob share a correlated state. Well, you do the obvious thing. Charlie does that measurement, gets that outcome, and there you go. So to give a bit more intuition for what these wires are, these cup and cap shaped wires are, that I said correspond to correlated states and effects. It's quite simple to prove using these tools that these have to be correlated. So assume for the sake of contradiction that all states separate, so that you don't have any correlations at all. Then as a special case of this, as I said, this cup-shaped wire is a particular state. It's got no input, it's got some output, so it's a state. So the same thing is true of that, it separates in this way. And then by this diagrammatic rule, we can rewrite it in this form, and then substitute in this constraint. And then you find that this means that your identity wire separates in the middle, which is kind of problematic for process theory, because this means that nothing is connected to anything. So this is completely trivial. This is the trivial sort of theory you can imagine. You don't have any connections between things at all. Everything just factorizes. There's no interaction, nothing. So if you want to have this generalized triisomorphism, this nice diagrammatic notation, for free you get correlations. And then as a final example to illustrate how the dagger is used, you can prove in this completely general framework, well, in this abstract framework, that all states that you can clone have to be orthogonal to each other. So suppose we have some isometry delta, which clones the states psi I. Diagrammatically, this is what that means. It means that if you take the process and then do its adjoint process, you get the identity, that is isometry. And then this is just a statement that it clones the psi I's. Then we can simply prove this. So if we compose the psi I with psi j, the dagger of psi j, then we can use this rule to substitute in the two copies of delta, and then use this rule to write it like this. And then the only numbers that satisfy this are going to be 0 and 1. So these states have to be orthogonal to each other. Or the same state or orthogonal to each other. Okay, so I hope this gives you a basic idea of like what this framework is useful for, how it works, and I'll try and move on with actually reconstructing quantum theory. So far, I've given you the basic introduction and a few examples that are useful in quantum foundations, and given this diagrammatic representation of these important symmetries in the theory, and shown how you can derive these kind of a fairly simple quantum results, but in an elegant diagrammatic way. And in particular, it's even though they're kind of simple results anyway, they're still much simpler to prove using the diagrammatic notation than standard notation. And we've seen that some of the important structure of quantum theory has been captured by these diagrammatic rules that we've introduced so far. Things like being perfect correlations and the dagger and this kind of thing are all quite fundamental to quantum theory. And we've started to capture them in a diagrammatic way. But importantly, as I said, things like probabilistic classical theory still satisfy everything we've got so far, so we've by no means reconstructed quantum theory yet. So this poses the question, what more do we actually need to throw in? What extra diagrammatic structure do we need to put in to our process theory to get back to quantum theory? So that's going to be the subject of the rest of my talk. Where I'll introduce the postulates and show how, I'll give a very, very rough sketch of how this ends up reconstructing quantum theory. So postulate number one is, you could probably have guessed this one, that the theory is a process theory. I don't think I need to say any more about that one. So moving on. The second postulate is that the theory has a classical interface. And that's, this classical interface is supposed to model how we interact with the world. It represents the choice that we can make over particular experiments to perform, and it represents the outcomes we get of seeing some pointer dial or some pointer on a dial on some experiment. So all the probability distributions we get when we gather some data from experiments. We need to be able to represent this in theory. So to formalize this, first thing is that we're going to need classical probability as a theory, as a sub-theory. And we'll give this its own notation purely for convenience. We could just label the systems as being classical if we wanted. But it's nicer to use some different notation. So we're going to use these light gray colored wires to represent classical things. So this then is some stochastic map from an n-level classical system to an m-level classical system. OK, so once we have this, these classical systems floating around, then the first part of the postulate is really classical control, which says how we control what happens in the world. And this is formalized by saying if you have some set of processes with input A and output B, then there's some process G, which has this extra classical system tagged on, which lets you choose which of the FIs is going to occur. Which means that if you put in state I and sort of set the classical system to be in state I, then FI is the process that happens. And then sort of like the other part is really that we want to say that it's through this classical interaction that we learn about the world as well. So this is the notion of tomography. This is formalized by saying that for every pair of systems you have, A and B, there's some test tau such that the following holds. So this says that if you have two processes, F and G, and they're actually the same process, then if you put them into this test, which has some classical input, which might choose which experiment to perform, and which has some classical outcome, which might include the data of the experiment, that if these two things are the same, then F and G are the same process. So this captures, I think, the standard notion of tomography that we would have for theory. And we'll, in fact, we'll strengthen this postulate slightly in a second. But to start with, I want to look at some of the consequences of this classical interface. Because this starts to push things in a direction that I think is more familiar to people that reconstruct quantum theory from the perspective of generalized probabilistic theories. So the first consequence is that if you have a set of processes with input A and output B, that these live inside some convex set. And moreover, that all of this composition of processes, everything acts linearly with respect to this convex structure. Moreover, we have a unique way to throw away systems, which we give this diagrammatic notation, this trace. So in quantum theory, this is the partial trace operation. And people that are familiar with GPTs, what we essentially have here are causal generalized probabilistic theories. There's some technical subtleties, but for practical purposes, this is basically causal GPTs. Or operational probabilistic theories, or whatever you want to call them. OK, so we're getting somewhere by introducing this classical interface to the theory. Namely, the starting point of most people's reconstructions of quantum theory. So I said we were going to strengthen the notion of tomography, though. And this is to say that it can be performed locally. So we don't need to do these big global measurements, these big global experiments. Instead, we can just locally probe our inputs and locally probe our outputs. And this is sufficient to characterize processes.
How do you justify that? Because people for a long time had the expectation that the universe would be local. And quantum theory disproved that, and now we use that as an axiom. What's the
So I think this is partly goes down to, this doesn't say you don't have sort of non-locality in the sense of Bell or in the sense of entanglement. Mm-hmm. This just says that you don't have any degrees of freedom that pop into existence out of nowhere when you compose systems together, which I think is still true. Well, this is still true in quantum theory, at least. I think it goes down to about what you mean by something being a system as well. A system, to me, is something that you can have in front of you and you can characterize it. So I think this would deny that sort of idea of what a system is to some extent. Having said that, there's like really well-behaved GPTs that don't satisfy this, such as real quantum theory, or quantum theory over real Hilbert spaces. So at the end of the day, you could argue against it as well, but theories such as real quantum theory are such well-behaved theories that at some point in any reconstructed quantum theory, you're going to have to put in something that gets rid of it. And here we go. If anyone can think of a nice way to rule out real quantum theory, I would be very interested to talk to them about it. Okay, so postulate three, however I'm counting these, is that the theory has these fundamental diagrammatic symmetries that I was introducing before. So it's got the dagger, it's got the ability to flip diagrams upside down, and you can bend wires around nicely. So it's got time reversal and these perfect correlations. And then this realizes this Z2 cross Z2 symmetry. This isn't quite enough for this postulate, in fact. It turns out that just the purely diagrammatic definition I've given of the dagger really isn't sufficient to capture this idea that it should correspond to time reversal symmetry.
What exactly does it mean for it to have a dagger? You're saying the dagger process is also a process?
Yeah. Well, there's a way to define what it means to flip processes upside down in a way that's consistent.
It's still in the theory.
But within quantum theory, there's a lot of different dagger structures that you could pick. One is the Hermitian adjoint, which is what we want, taking unitaries to the unitaries that undo the time evolution. But there's also other ones that you could pick. For example, the transpose itself actually corresponds to a dagger structure. It's just not really the one that we want. So we've got to refine things a bit. We've got to sharpen the dagger so that we get the right one. And this means to say that if you have some state deprivation process, so you've got some classical choice over which state it's happening, then we want the dagger of this to correspond to a test for that state deprivation procedure. Which means, up to some technicalities which I'm not going to get into for lack of time, that if this is a testable set of states, i.e. it's like pure and perfectly distinguishable, or diagrammatic equivalent of that, then composing this with its dagger gives you the identity. So the states in this are uniquely picked out by that measurement. And moreover, if this n is the maximal amount of pure and perfect distinguishable states you can have, then this thing is a proper complete measurement. But intuitively, we're just trying to add in some extra postulate to make sure that we pick the right dagger in the case of quantum theory.
Is it clear why the transpose doesn't satisfy?
Yeah, so if you take the transpose of if you take the transpose in the computational basis of the y eigenstates, then if you take y transpose composed with y, it gives you zero. So this would, if you had one of those eigenstates here, you would fail this rule. I'm not sure that's an intuitive explanation, but it's simple to show that it's true. I think it's something that we could do with understanding better, is why in some theories the transpose and the dagger seem to coincide with each other and why in some they don't. It's sort of a weird feature of quantum theory that these two things are different. In classical theory, they're the same, in real quantum theory, they're the same. So further research go into that, definitely. Okay, and then the final postulate that I'm going to use for the reconstruction is called the dagger symmetric purification principle. And this is based on the purification principle that was introduced by Giulio Chirabella, Paolo Perinotti, and Mauro Dariano in their reconstruction of quantum theory, which was in the operational probabilistic theory framework. And for them, took this principle as a generalization of the Stein-Spring dilation theorem. It said that if you have some pure state, some mixed state in your theory, you can always find a bipartite state, which is pure, and where you trace out the new system you've introduced, you get back your original mixed state. And then they have an essential uniqueness condition, which says that if you've got two of these purifications, then they're the same up to reversible transformation. I have a few issues with this postulate. Happy to chat about that at the end. But now I'll introduce what my version of their postulate is. So what it says fundamentally is that nature, on some fundamental level, can be described by pure processes and by having lack of access to the past or the future of some systems. So if we have any process F with input A and output B, then we can find some pure process, capital F, with input AB and output AB, such that we don't have access to B, we don't have access to A, which is represented by throwing away A and the dagger of throwing away B. And moreover, these purifications are essentially unique, which is to say that if we've got two of them, they're related by some transformation. Again, I'll leave the technical details of that to afterwards, people are interested. So that's all of the postulates that I'm going to impose.
On the last slide, here was defined as not a mixture of any other.
Again, that's something we can talk about afterwards if there's time.
Is it not that then?
No.
I
haven't defined what purity is. There's a notion of purity that you can define process theoretically, which doesn't coincide with the standard notions of purity. For what I would really argue are good reasons, and that this is the correct way of defining purity, and those other ones are wrong. But it's too tangential to go into now, so feel free to talk later if you want to know about that. But there's a well-defined notion of purity for which F is pure. Okay, so what are the consequences of these four postulates that I've introduced? Well, you can show that the processes live inside convex cones, not just convex sets. And moreover, these convex cones are homogeneous and strongly self-dual, which means that the systems in my theory correspond to Euclidean John algebras. Doesn't particularly matter what any of that means. It's just that's sort of the stepping stones on the way to reconstruction for those that are familiar with this jargon. The key thing is that the only Euclidean Jordan algebras that then compose correctly according to our postulates, i.e. that satisfy this topographic local postulate and that have the ability to bend wires around, are theta algebras. Which means that our process theory corresponds to completely positive maps between finite dimensional theta algebras. And as I mentioned way back towards the start, this is exactly what we mean by the process theoretic characterization of quantum theory. Again, if anyone wants to argue why this isn't the correct version of correct description of quantum theory, we can argue about that at the end as well. But this is essentially what we're aiming for in our reconstruction. So this is it, basically. Those four postulates mean that we get to a process theory which is quantum theory. Okay, so to summarize this, given the process theory framework that I introduced at the start, and this finite local probabilistic classical interface for the theory representing how we interact with the world, and then given these diagrammatic symmetries involving the time reversal symmetry and also the perfect correlations that you get by bending wires around, and that the dagger in particular corresponds to one of these sharp daggers rather than just some arbitrary dagger that you could come up with for the theory, so that it really captures the notion of time reversal in a more accurate way than the standard notion does. Finally, if you have these dagger symmetric purifications saying that nature is fundamentally pure and time symmetric and all impurity and asymmetry arises from lack of access to certain systems, then you get the process of descriptive quantum theory. Okay, so finally, to conclude, I'll talk about the limitations of this approach and where I think we should go next in trying to reconstruct quantum theory. So the first is that I sort of snuck in this finite dimensionality assumption, which, as far as I'm aware, nearly all reconstructions of quantum theory, at least modern ones, do this as well. You could try and argue that the nature should be fundamentally finite dimensional, so this isn't a problem, but I don't see any mathematically good reason why we shouldn't attempt to go for dimensional quantum theory as well. So this seems like a natural next step. And there's some work by Stefano Gaggioso and Fabrizio Genovese, who are also in the group in Oxford, where they come up with a way of describing categorically infinite dimensional quantum theory using non-standard analysis. And I don't have a clue how this really works, but it seems like one possible avenue to approach the idea of going for a full infinite dimensional reconstruction of quantum theory. The second direction I think we would want to go in is to try and avoid introducing this classical interface in the first place, to try and avoid having sort of any agent-centric sort of notions about classicality and about how I model myself within the theory. This has been done to some extent in another reconstruction that's come out recently by Sean Tull, who's also in the group in Oxford, where he managed to get pretty much all of the structure of quantum theory from categorical assumptions, apart from the fact that you use complex numbers to describe quantum theory. And at some point, he has to put in a little bit by hand, and one way of justifying that bit that he puts in by hand would be to appeal to probabilities and say that ultimately he wants to describe our theory probabilistic. But it seems like a good starting point in trying to get away from this classical interface that we've introduced. Okay, thanks for listening. Any questions?
After postulates 1 and 2, you said that you were recovering GPTs. Mm-hmm. The caveat, can you explain a little more on the caveat?
The caveat is essentially, I think the only difference is that in GPT frameworks, people tend to assume that the convex cones are closed. We don't make that assumption, or we don't derive that from our postulates. Sorry, we don't derive it from the classical interface.
So those postulates are broader than all GPTs. It's GPTs plus.
Depends on precisely what framework of GPTs you use. If you use the operational probabilistic theories of the Pavia group, then they have this causality axiom, which is the existence of this unique discarding effect that I said we get from our interface. But they assume closure, so it's sort of a trade-off. They're not, one doesn't obviously subsume the other. I think from my point of view, the idea that you have this unique way to throw away systems is a very natural assumption. And so I think all of, it subsumes a large proportion of the GPTs that people tend to care about, at least, and would have this non-closure thing to play around with if anyone thinks there's anything interesting to be found there. I'm not convinced there is. People tend to justify it by saying that these cones should be closed because the closure of a cone is going to be operationally indistinguishable from the cone itself, so just take it closed for mathematical convenience. I think that's one way of arguing it, but I could imagine that there's some way around that sort of argument, and that by having open cones, you could possibly have something different. Like a non-closed cone. A non-closed cone, so one where some parts of the boundary aren't part of the cone.
Why did you, so I didn't understand your motivation for not wanting to invoke a classical interface. You used the word agency. I didn't see how agency was involved.
Well, agency might not be the best word, but to justify the existence of the classical interface, you've got to say that, like, this is how I am going to interact with the world, that probabilities are important and that it's, we do experiments, we get probability distributions out of them, and that we're going to characterize things in terms of those, and we want to describe this internally to the theory, and all of this kind of stuff. And if we're trying to really make the process theory, like the sort of foundations of physics, you don't really want to have that as the foundations and then also some of this probabilistic stuff competing with it. So there's an attempt to drive out the probabilistic aspects as much as possible and focus on the compositional aspects. So the idea would be if we could have postulates that were purely compositional and didn't appeal to probability theory at any point, that would be more true to the sort of the spirit of process theories. Whether you like that sort of approach or whether you think probabilities are fine and we should go with them, that's on some level a matter of personal taste. I think for me it would be interesting to try and push out as much information as possible. But
it's related to something else I wanted to ask, you said something about probabilistic classical sub-theories.
Yeah.
Included, but, so would your construction not have worked if you thought that classical theories are deterministic?
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to do any of this with a deterministic classical theory. You don't get any convex structure out of it. So the convex structure comes from the convexity of the classical interface, and then you push that through. You'd get some structure. It might capture something like pure quantum theory, but I would imagine that would probably not work. But no, definitely not. Yeah, you shouldn't get much if you take deterministic classical physics as your interface. I'm not sure how you would characterize quantum theory in any framework without probabilities appearing at some stage, though.
So the assumption of the classical interface, did that just amount to saying that the scalars are probabilities?
No, it was stronger than that. It said that you have this classical control, that you can choose which process occurs based on some bigger process with a classical input. And it said that processes were characterized by how they interact with the classical sub-theory. So that was the tomography assumption that by just choosing classical inputs and looking at the output, classical outputs you get, that you can characterize any process in that way. You don't need to, there's nothing to be learnt in nature that isn't accessible classically, if you run enough experiments.
And the thing about, so what it gives you is CP maps between C-star algebra,
yeah,
which is, I guess, more general than just saying between operators in Hilbert space.
Yeah.
Particularly.
Yeah, so
what does that give you? Like,
so this means that you can start to represent, so implicit in there being a classical interface is that you've got to have classical systems around. And if you limit yourself to standard quantum theory of just completely positive maps between operators in Hilbert space, then you'd have no way to encode classical systems. Your classical systems just aren't there. So by going to C-star algebra, it allows you to have your sort of classical sector, your quantum sector, and then some sort of super-selected intermediate systems as well, which should be there, given the other stuff.
In the sense that the system can be either completely quantum or completely classical, but cannot be hybrid.
No, so we get the hybrid as well.
In this, yeah.
Yeah.
In the C-star algebra, but if you were just thinking in terms of operators on a Hilbert space, then.
So you'd want like a classical sector, quantum sector, and no hybrid sector, essentially.
Okay.
That was the idea.
Yeah. Is that the case, or is that what you're saying?
So that's not what I'm trying to get to.
Okay.
I think some people would argue that that is what I should be trying to get to. And I can show how you can do that if you want to see that. But I think for me, all of these extra systems really come for free when you start having classical control. Once you, and branching structure arising from measurements. Essentially, you should be able to condition what system you have on some classical data, as well as conditioning what process happens on some classical data. And as soon as you allow that, which seems very natural given the idea of classical control, then you want to get all of the C-star algebras and not just the completely classical, completely quantum ones.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
You mentioned when you presented postulate 4 that there were reasons that you didn't really like it that you could elaborate on.
Yeah. So my problem with the standard purification postulate is that it doesn't hold in classical. And so we're trying to have these, because we want to get to this C-star algebraic formulation where we've got the classical system and the quantum systems. This means that all of our postulates also have to hold for classical theory as well as quantum theory. And so in the peer group, they use the purification postulate as the thing that separates out quantum and classical theory. And so they rule out classical theory with that.
Right.
It's simple to see that in that classical theory doesn't have any pure correlated states, so you just don't have enough pure bipartite states to give you all of your mixed states back. So that their purification postulate fails for that, but we want to keep classical theory, so by modifying it in this way, it applies to classical theory as well as quantum theory.
When you were talking about the CGI isomorphism and how you represent that in processes, maybe this is just my lack of knowledge, but the CGI isomorphism has this isomorphism between states and channels.
Yeah.
Is there also an isomorphism between states, channels, and measurements?
Yeah, so once you have these wires that you can bend around, you get a load more than just the standard ones for free. So the standard one is something like mapping a channel to a state like that. But you could also map it to an effect like this, or you can do the transpose thing I showed before. Or you can take some effect and turn it into a state, or if you have something with multiple inputs and outputs, then you can define things like partial transpose, and blah, blah, blah. So by giving it this diagrammatic structure, you see that it's a part of a much sort of wider family of phenomena than just its standard presentation.
What advantages does this process theoretical approach give as against the diagrammatic approach?
Say that again, Sly.
What advantages do you get when you approach this problem through a process theoretic perspective as opposed to a diagrammatic perspective?
So I would say that. What's gone? Broadly, I see the two as being the same thing. The diagrammatic use of diagrams is really central to the whole process theoretic framework. Other approaches to reconstructing quantum theory have also used diagrams as well, but they tend to use diagrams, I'd say, more as a mathematical framework they're working in, rather than trying to take them as the basis of all of the postulates as well. So they would still treat states as like a fundamental entity and try and characterize the state space and try and have postulates that were all about the states of the theory. Whereas here, we want to talk about processes as the fundamental entity and how they compose and try and make all of the postulates as much as possible about processes. So I think that's what distinguishes my process theoretic approach from sort of other diagrammatic approaches to reconstruction quantum theory.
Okay, if there are more questions, let's start John again.